Systems, machines, and books cast down, speeding humanity along the path of redemption. Neither seemed to fear the chance of renewed war, so clear was the contempt each held for the other. At the moment, it hardly mattered. "We are in the hands of maniacs," Sarah thought. "Fools who will ruin us all." Asks. And now returns the Rothen ship, back from its cryptic mission, probing nearby space for some unknown god purpose, back to collect the station it left behind and its crew of biological prospectors, back to gather up a treasure hold of purloined genes, back to cover up their crime. Only now that erstwhile buried station gapes before us a twisted ruin. One Rothen and a sky human lie on makeshift biers, robbed of life, while the surviving visitor invaders rage choleric, vowing retribution. If any doubted their intent before my rings, can it be ambiguous any more? We are bound to be punished. Only means and extent remain in doubt. This is what the rebel zealots desired. No more confusion, an end to hints and sweet lying promises. Only the cleanliness of righteous opposition, however uneven our powers against those we must resist. Let us be judged, the zealots demand, by our courage and faith, not our hesitation. The hot, unwinking star moves across our pre-dawn sky, orbiting slowly closer, an angel or demon of vengeance. Do those aboard already know what has happened? Are they even now plotting the storm to come? The zealots argue we must seize the survivors, Roken, Ling, and Ron, as hostages for the protection of every member of the Commons, and the remaining Starman, Kun, when his aircraft returns to its shattered base. Horrified, our Kerwinish High Sage, knife-bright insight, skewers the zealot logic. You would pile one crime on another? Did they harm us, these aliens? Did they strike the first blow with their clinics and high-paying jobs? You have slain two of them based on mere speculation of ill intent. Now you would kidnap the rest? Let us imagine that those on the ship agree to your demands, promising not to attack the six. What is to stop them changing their minds once the hostages go free? The zealot chief replies, Who says they will go free? Let them dwell among us for the rest of their natural spans, living as deterrents to alien vileness. And after that? How foolish to think in terms of mere lifespans. Star gods ponder long thoughts. They plan long plans. To slay us now, or in 50 years, what difference will that make in the grand scheme of things? Some onlookers murmur agreement. To others, however, it is as if the sage has made a fine joke. They laugh in various ways and shout, "It makes a big difference to those now alive." "Anyway," the Irish leader of the zealots adds, "you are wrong to say they had not yet attacked us or attempted villainous harm. To the contrary, our justified explosive feat stopped their vile scheme just in time." Soot-stained and fatigued, Lester Campbell sits on a nearby boulder. Now he lifts his head from his hands and asks,
"What do you mean by that?"
"I mean their foul intent was to begin a program of annihilation by igniting fratricidal war among the six."
The gathered onlookers absorb this silently. Knife-bright insight demands,
"Can you prove this?"
"Solid, irrefutable evidence is on the way. But first, should you not hear supportive testimony from your own highly revered fellow sage?"
Confusion reigns until Fahundau steps forward to speak. Our Hoonish colleague has been strangely silent, taking little part in events, save to carry Vubbin downhill from the ill-starred pilgrimage. Now his long, scaly spine unbends, as if glad to pass a heavy burden.
"It is too short a time that I have had to ruminate upon these matters," he demurs.
"You would ruminate a geologic age, dear friend," Lester Campbell jests in a gentle way. "Even your most tentative wisdom is greater than any other, except the eggs. Please share it with us."
A deep rolling sound emanates from Fahundau's pendulous vibrating sac.
"For almost two Jaduras, I have kept careful records of statements made by our guests from space, especially those spoken formally, as if written by someone else, for the sky humans to say aloud. I had several linguistic reference works from Byblos, which I sometimes consult when judging disputes between individuals of different races, speaking different tongues. Despite our local dialect devolution, these works contain useful charts regarding syntax and variable meaning. I do not claim great expertise, just a backwoods practicality in scrutinizing the aliens' statements."
"But you reached conclusions?"
"Not conclusions. Correlations, perhaps, indicating a possible pattern of intent."
"Intent?"
"Intent. To incite divisiveness."
Urjah comments from the wallow, where she curls in exhaustion from the futile rescue effort, scratching for survivors amid the smoky ruin of the alien station.
This is not the first time such a suspicion has been raised. We all have anecdotes to tell of innocent-sounding remarks which sting gently at first, like a shadow fly laying eggs that fester a wound that never heals. Now you say there is a consistent pattern, that this was part of a deliberate plan. Why did you not speak this before?
Fahoon Dao sighs. A good scholar does not publish provisional data. Also, the aliens seemed unaware that we have retained this skill, charting the meaning in phrases. Or rather, that we recovered it with the great printing. I saw no reason to leak the fact too soon. He shrugs like a treiki, with a left-right twist. I finally became convinced when Roken spoke to us all during the pilgrimage. Surely it occurred to some of you that his aim was to strike sparks of dissension with his words.
It sure did.
Lester Campbell growls. Assent echoes loudly from many humans present, as if to convince others of their sincerity. Hoofed urs stamp uncertainly, their hot tempers clearly frayed from the long, enervating night. Only hard-won habits of the recent peace have kept things calm till now. Fahoon Dao continues,
the formal dialect of Galactic Six used by the Rothan Star God allows little room for ambiguity. Roken's disconcerting words can have but two possible interpretations. Either he is tactless to a degree beyond all stupidity, or else the objective was to incite a campaign of genocide against human sept.
Against their own beloved clients?
Urja asks, incredulous.
That is irrelevant, even if the Rothan claim of patronhood is true. Why should they care about one small, isolated band of feral humans, long cut off from the race as a whole, genetically inbred and several hundred years out of date, perchance even defective, psychologically backward, polluted by...
You've made your point...
Lester interrupts testily.
But in that case, why pick on us?
Fahoon Dao turns to our human peer, humbling apologetically.
Because among the six, man's sept is greatest in its technic lore, in its imperfect but useful recollection of galactic ways, and in its well-remembered skill at the art of war.
There rises a muttering from some Kalanish and Urish listeners, yet no actual disagreement. Not from anyone who knows the tale of Battle Canyon, or Townsend's ambush, or the siege of Tarik Town.
All of these factors make your kind the obvious first target, Moreover, there is another reason. The effect your race has had upon the rest of us. As newcomers, when your rank was lowest, still you opened your sole treasure, your library, to all. After your great victories, when your status towered highest, you refused many privileges of dominance. Instead, bowing to the sages, accepting limits called for by the great peace. It is this record of restraint that makes you dangerous to Rothan plans. For what good is it to incite war if your intended victims choose not to fight?
Yes, my rings, we observe, note, the crowd's reaction. A hush, as Fuhundao evokes images of reconciliation, gently dousing still simmering sparks of resentment. It is a masterwork of mediation.
Once Mansept is gone,
Fuhundao goes on,
it would prove simple to goad disaffection among the rest, pretending secret friendships, offering assistance, handing over tailored plagues, for instance, letting each race come up with clever ways to deliver death bugs to their foes. Within less than a generation, the job would be complete. The sparse record left on Jijo's soil would show only that 6 Sooner races once sank low here, never reaching redemption.
Uneasy silence greets this scenario painted by our Hoonish sage.
Of course, none of this is proven,
Fuhundao concludes, rounding to stab a finger toward the zealot chieftain.
Nor does it justify the horrors we have seen this night, perpetrated rashly, without consulting the sages or the commons.
The Urish rebel lifts her head high in order to peer over the crowd toward the east. With a glad snort, she turns back to Fuhundao.
Now arrives your proof.
She whistles jubilantly, helping shove an opening through the ranks of spectators as dawn reveals dusty figures galloping down the trail from the holy glade.
Here also is your justification.
Lark. Harulan called down from the crater's edge.
You two had better come up now,
the heretic shouted.
Someone's going to catch you, and it'll mean trouble. Besides, I think something's happening.
Physical and emotional exhaustion had taken their toll of the gray aristocrat's polished accent. He sounded frantic, as if serving as reluctant lookout were as risky as poking through perilous wreckage.
"What's happening?"
Uthan shouted back. Though a cousin to the Kellen above, Lark's fellow biologist looked like a different species, with his scarred carapace streaked by gummy ash.
"Are they sending a robot this way?"
Harulan's leg vents fluted overtones of worry.
No, the machines still hover protectively over Roken, and the two servant humans and the cadavers, all surrounded by a crowd of local sycophants. I refer to a commotion over where the sages have been holding court. More zealots have arrived, it seems. There is ferment. I'm certain we are missing important news.
Harulin may be right, Lark thought. Yet he was reluctant to leave. Despite the stench, heat, and jagged stubs of metal, all made more dangerous by his own fatigue, dawn was making it easier to prowl the ruins of the buried station in search of anything to help make sense of it all. How many times had he seen Ling vanish down a ramp into these secret precincts, wondering what lay inside? Now it was a blackened hell. "I aided the zealots," he recalled. "I gave them copies of my reports. I knew they were going to do something, but I never figured anything as brutal as this." Neither had the star gods, who clearly never guessed that angry primitives might still know how to make things go boom. They never asked the right questions.
"I tell you, something's happening,"
Harulin shouted again, making no effort at originality.
"The sages are in motion toward the aliens."
Lark glanced over at Uthan and sighed. "I guess he means it this time." His friend had been silent for some time, standing over the same spot. When Uthan replied, it was in a low voice that barely disturbed the ash beneath his feet.
"Lark, would you please come look at this?"
Lark knew that tone from past field trips, exploring for evidence of Jijo's complex living past. He picked his way toward the Cowan, slipping gingerly between torn metal braces and seared buckled plating, lifting his feet to kick up as little of the nasty dust ash as possible. "What is it? Did you find something?"
"I am not sure."
Uthan lapsed into Gal 6.
"It seems I have seen this before. This symbol. This representation. Perhaps you can confirm?"
Lark bent alongside his friend, peering into a recess where the rising sun had yet to shine. There he saw a jumble of rectangular lozenges, each thick as his hand and twice as long. Uthan had scraped aside some half-melted machinery in order to reveal the pile. One slab lay near enough to make out a symbol, etched across its dark brown surface. A double spiral with a bar through it. Now where have I seen? Lark's hand reached where Uthan could not, stroked the rectangle, then picked it up. It felt incredibly light, though now it dawned on him that it could be the weightiest thing he had ever touched. "Are you thinking what I'm thinking?" he asked, turning it in the light. Uthan plucked the slab from his hand, holding it in a trembling claw.
"How can I not be?"
the Kewanish scholar replied.
"Even half-animal reverted primitives should recognize the glyph of the Great Galactic Library."
The evidence lay strewn across the trampled grass. Roken's piercing eyes surveyed a tangle of wires and glossy spheroids that the zealots had recently brought down from the Valley of the Egg. Clogs of dirt still clung to a necklace of strange objects, from where it had till lately been buried, next to the holiest site on Jijo. Two clusters of onlookers formed semicircles, one backing the assembled sages, the other reverently standing behind the star god. Many in the second group had been patients at the Forayer's Clinic, or believed their claims of righteousness above all law. Among the humans on that side, faith in their rediscovered patrons seemed to glow, depicted by Lark's new Rauk as intense red fire, surrounding their faces. Gone was the Rothen's prior mien of furious wrath. Roken's humanoid features once more conveyed charismatic poise, even serene indulgence. He spent another dura looking over the jumble of parts, then spoke in prim Galactic 7. "I see nothing here of interest. Why do you show me these things?" Lark expected the young Urish radical, leader of the rebel zealots, to answer, as both plaintiff and defendant, justifying her group's violence by diverting blame to the aliens. But the young dissenter kept well back, huddling with a crowd of humans and Urs, consulting texts. The Hoonish sage, Fahundau, stepped forward to confront the Rothen emissary.
"We seek to ascertain whether these tools of high acumen are yours, tools which some of our children found within the last turning of Jijo's axis, tools which someone buried surreptitiously in close contact with our beloved egg."
Lark watched Ling's reaction. Since he already knew her pretty well, no Rauk was needed to translate her shock of recognition, nor the embarrassment that followed as she worked things out in her own head. "That's all I needed to know," Lark thought. Roken seemed nonchalant.
"I can only guess that some among you natives placed it there, as your foolish rebels placed explosives under our station."
Now Ling's reaction was to blink in surprise. She didn't expect to hear him lie, at least not so baldly, with no time to prepare a smooth performance. Glancing to one side, the Star Woman noticed Lark's scrutiny and quickly looked away. Lark wasn't proud of the satisfaction he felt over the reversal of their moral positions. Now it was her turn to feel ashamed.
"Use your instrumentalities," Fahundau urged the tall Rothen. "Analyze these implements. You will find the technology far beyond anything we six can now produce."
Roken shrugged with an elegant roll of his shoulders.
"Perhaps they were left by the Buyer."
"In that place?" Fahundau boomed amusement, as if Roken had made a good-natured jest. "Only a century ago, that entire valley glowed white hot from the egg's passage to the upper world. These tendrils would not have survived."
The crowd murmured. Lark felt a tug on his sleeve. He glanced around to see that a short blonde figure, Bloor the portraitist, had slinked up behind, bearing a box camera and tripod.
"Let me shoot under your arm," the photographer whispered urgently.
Lark felt a frisson of panic. Was Bloor mad? Trying this in the open, with the robots at their wariest? Even if Lark's body shielded that angle, people on both sides would see. Despite Fahundau's masterful performance, could they count on loyalty from everyone in the milling throng? With a helpless sigh, he lifted his left arm enough for Bloor to aim at the confrontation on the glade.
"Then I have no other explanation for these items,"
Roken answered, referring to the snarled mass of gear.
"You are welcome to speculate to the extent that you are able until our ship arrives."
Ignoring the implied threat, the Hoonish sage went on with an air of calm reason that made the Rothen seem edgy by comparison.
is speculation required? It's been asserted that several sets of eyes observed your robots on a recent foggy night, deliberately implanting these devices underneath our sacred stone.
Impossible!
Roken burst forth, temper once more flaring. No life forms were in any position to witness on that night. Careful scans beforehand showed no sentient beings within range when... The Rothan emissary trailed off mid-sentence, while onlookers stared, awed and amazed, that an urbane star god could be succored by so obvious a ploy. He must be awfully accustomed to getting his way, Lark thought, to fall for such a simple trap. Then a strange notion occurred to him. Many earthly cultures, from ancient Greece and India to high California, depicted their gods as spoiled temperamental adolescents. Could that be racial memory? Maybe these guys really are our long-lost patrons after all.
Thank you for the correction, Fuhundao answered with a graceful bow. I only said it was so asserted. I shall rebuke those who suggested it. We will take your word that there were no witnesses on the night that you now admit your robots planted these strange alien devices next to our egg. Shall we leave that aspect now and proceed to why they were planted in the first place?
Roken appeared to be chewing on his mistake, working his jaw like a human grinding his teeth. Lark's rauk showed a discolored swath that seemed to ripple across the upper part of the Rothan's face. Meanwhile, Bloor whispered contentment as he took another picture, pushing a cover slide over the exposed plate. Go away, Lark silently urged the little man, to no avail.
I see no further purpose to be served by this session, the alien finally announced.
He turned and began to move away, only to stop when confronted by the gaping crater where his station once lay, recalling that he had no place to go. Of course, Roken could climb aboard a robot and simply fly off, but till either Kuhn's aircraft or the starship arrived, there was only wilderness to flee to. No shelter beyond this glade, filled with inconvenient questions. A shout rose up from the cluster of Urs and men over to the left. The huddle broke, revealing a beaming Lester Campbell, burdened by several large-format volumes as he hurried forward.
"I think we found it," he announced,
kneeling with several assistants beside one of the spheroidal knobs that ran along the tangled mass of cable. While an aide pried at the box, Lester explained.
Naturally, none of us has the slightest idea how this device works, but galactic tech is so refined and simplified, after a billion years, that most machines are supposed to be pretty easy to use. After all, if humans could pilot a creaky fifth-hand starship all the way to Jijo, the things must be darn near idiot-proof.
The self-deprecating jest drew laughter from both sides of the crowd. Pressing close to watch, the throng left no easy or dignified avenue for Roken or his servants to escape.
"In this case," Campbell continued, "we assume the gadget was meant to go off when all the pilgrims were in place near the egg, at our most impressionable, perhaps as we finished the invocation. A good guess would be either a timer or some remote control trigger, possibly a radio signal."
An aide succeeded in getting the cover off with an audible pop.
Now, let's see if we can find something like the standard manual override switch they show on page 1512.
Lester said, crouching closer, consulting one of the open volumes. Roquen stared at the book, filled with crisp diagrams, as if he had just seen something deadly creep out of his own bedsheets. Lark noticed that Ling was looking at him once again. This time, her expression seemed to say, "What have you been hiding from me?" Although she lacked a rouge, Lark figured a wry smile would convey his reply.
"You assume too much, my dear. It blinded you, preventing you from asking sound questions. It also made you patronizing when we might have been friends."
All right, maybe that was too complex to transmit by facial expression alone. Perhaps what his smirk actually said was, "Such nerve! You accuse me of hiding things?"
"I protest," interjected the male sky human Ron, towering over all but the Hoon and a few Treyiki as he stepped forward. "You have no right to meddle with the property of others."
Fuhundao crooned softly.
"Then you avow ownership of this invasive thing, placed without permission in our most sacred site?"
Ron blinked. Clearly, he hated the present weakness of the alien's position, having to fence words with savages. Confused, the tall sky human turned to Roquen for guidance. While they conferred, heads close together, Lester Campbell continued.
"The purpose of this contraption was what had us stymied for a while. Fortunately, I'd already been doing some research on galactic technology, so the texts were somewhat familiar. Finally, I found it listed under psi emitters."
"Here's the switch, sir," an aide declared. "Ready when you are."
Lester Campbell stood up, raising both hands.
"People, this is a first and final warning. We've no idea what we're about to set off. I assume nothing fatal, since our guests aren't flying out of here at top speed. However, since we've no time for careful experiments, I advise you to at least step back. The cautious among you may retreat some greater distance, perhaps twice the diameter of the egg. I'll count down from 10.
"Uthin wanted to stay and watch," Lark thought. "But I made him go hide those library disk things we found. Did I actually do him a favor?"
Campbell drew a deep breath.
10, 9, 8.
Lark had never seen a Gekek outrace an Urz before. But as the crowd dissolved, some of the six showed surprising haste to depart. Others remained, tethered by curiosity.
"Courage is one trait that binds any true union," he thought with some pride.
7, 6.
Now Roquen himself glided forward.
"I avow ownership of this device, which..."
5, 4.
Roquen hurried, speaking louder to be heard past the tumult.
"Which consists merely of instrumentation innocently emplaced." 3, 2.
Faster and frantic tones.
"2 study patterns cast by your revered and sacred 1. Now."
Some humans instinctively brought their hands up to their ears, crouching and squinting as if to protect their eyes against an expected flash. Urz pressed arms over pouches, Gekeks drew in their eyes, while Kewins and Treyiki squat-hugged the ground. Rauk cringed, fleeing the intense emotions pouring from their hosts. Whatever a psi emitter might be, everyone was about to find out. Lark tried to ignore instinct, taking his cue instead from Ling. Her response to the countdown seemed a queer mix of anger and curiosity. She clasped both hands together, turning to meet his eyes at the very moment Campbell's aide stroked a hidden switch. Asks.
Confusion brims our central core, oozing through the joint seals that bind us, we, I, me, seeping bewilderment down our outer curves like sap from a wounded tree. This voice, this rhythmic recitation, can it be what we know it not to be? The egg's patternings have stroked us so many ways. This ruction has familiar elements, like the sacred one's way of singing. Yet there is also a metallic tang, simplistic, lacking the egg's sonorous pitch and timbre. One sub-cadence draws us toward it, clattering like a hasty quintet of claws, pulling our attention as if down a dark underground funnel. Suddenly, we coalesce, submerging into strange existence as a unified being, one encased in a hard shell. Pentagonal resentment surges. This me is filled with rage.
How dare they tell me I am free? What unnatural law is this code of the commons? This rule that liberates my kind from the sweet discipline we once knew, imposed by our gracious queens? We who are blue, we who are red, surely we yearn to serve, deepen our throbbing bile nodes, to work and fight selflessly, assisting gray dynastic ambitions? Was that not our way among the stars and before? The native way of all Kewans? Who dared bring an end to those fine days, forcing alien notions of liberty into carapaces too stiff for a deadly drug called freedom? Humans dared impose these thoughts, breaking up the union of our well-ordered hives. Theirs is the fault, the shell-bound debt to pay, and pay they shall. After that, there will be other scores to settle.
We writhe, experiencing what it feels like to crouch and run on five strong legs, legs meant for service, not to a mere nest crouched behind some puny dam or to some vast abstraction like the commons, but to grand gray matrons, noble, gorgeous, and strong. Why does this vivid perception flood through our dazzled core? It must be the Rothen artifice, their psi device, part of their scheme to influence each race of the six, tricking us into doing their will. Quivers of surprise shake our my rings. Even after so many years of friendship, we had never realized the Kewan point of view is so weird. Yet no weirder than the next sensation that comes barging into our shared consciousness, the feel of galloping hooves, a hot breath of the dry steppes, the burning flare of a psyche at least as egocentric as any human being.
Now I am Urishka. Solitary, proud as the day I emerged from the grass, little more than a beast, nervous but self-reliant. I may join the tribe or clan that adopts me off the plain. I may obey a leader, for life has hierarchies that one must endure. Yet inside I serve one mistress, me. Can humans ever know how their gross smell scrapes my nostril membranes? They make good warriors and smiths, it's true. They brought fine music to Jijo. These are valid things. Yet one conceives how much better the world would be without them. We had fought our way up high before they came. From the plains to fiery mountaintops, we stretched our necks over all others on Jijo, till these bipeds dragged us down, to be just another race among six. Worse, their lore reminds us, me, how much we have lost, how much is forgotten. Each day they make me recall how low and brief my life is doomed to be here on this spinning ball of mud with bitter oceans all around.
The indignant narration gallops past our ability to follow. Its resentful thread is lost, but another takes its place, imposed from the outside by a force that throbs through the little mountain vale. This beat is much easier to follow, a cadence that is heavy, slow to anger, and yet, once roused, its ire seems hopeless to arrest short of death.
It is not a rhythm to be rushed, still it beckons us to ponder how often the quicker races tease we poor patient hoon, how they swirl around us, how often they seem to talk fast on purpose, how they set us to the most dangerous tasks. To face the sea alone, although each lost ship wrenches 100 loved ones, tearing our small families apart with wrenching pain. Humans and their stinking steamboats, they have kept the skills, pretending to share, but not really. Some day they will leave us rotting here, while they go off on ships made of pure white light. Should this be allowed? Are there ways they can be made to pay?
Confusion reigns. If these pernicious messages were meant for each separate race to sway it toward aggression, then why are we, I, receiving all of them? Should the Rothan not have targeted each sept to hear one theme alone? Perhaps their machine is damaged or weak. Perhaps we are stronger than they thought. Breaking free of the hoonish rhythm, we sense that two layers of bitter song remain. One is clearly meant for earthlings. Reverence is its theme. Reverence and pride.
We are superior. Others specialize, but we can do anything. Chosen and raised by mighty Rothan, it is proper that we be greatest, even as castaways on this slope of savages. If taught their place, the others might learn roles of worthy service.
I recall a phrase, direct empathic transmission, a technique used by galactic science for the better part of 500 million years. Knowing makes the maniport stream of voice seem more artificial, tinny, even self-satirical. Of course, this message was to have been amplified somehow through our holy egg at a time when we would be most receptive. Even so, it is hard to imagine such prattle winning many believers. Did they actually think we would fall for this? Another fact penetrates our attention. There is no layer for the wheeled ones. Why is that? Why are the Gekek left out? Is it because of their apparent uselessness in a program of genocidal war? Or because they were already extinct, out there among the stars? One resonance remains, a drumbeat, like hammers pounding on stacks of stiff, round tubes. A reverberation that howls in a manner this composite self finds eerily familiar.
yet in some ways it is the most alien of all.
Macro entity, priestly declaration, direct from oration peak of knowing ID irate hostility. Response equals vowed end to personal insult. Let perpetrators, earthling, face annihilation.
We shrivel back, dismayed. This egomania is far greater than any of the other broadcasts, even those aimed at Urs and men. And yet, it is aimed at Treyiki. Do you see what is happening, my rings? Is this a taste of the proud willfulness that used to flow from coercive despot Tauruses? Those tyrant psyches that once dominated our cognition rings? Overlord collars that were abandoned on purpose by the Treyiki founders when they fled to Jijo? Is this how resentment tasted to those haughty Jofer? Yes, shudder at the name. Mighty beings who still prowl the stars in our image. Ring cousins whose waxy cores are ruled by monomaniacal ravings. If so, why do these rantings mean so little to our many-colored segments? Knowing them for what they are, why do they seem so banal, so uncompelling? The demonstration ends. All the scraping emissions fade as power runs out of the alien device. No matter. We now know the purpose of this tangle of cables and balls: to cast poison, amplified and lent credibility by passage through the egg. All around the meadow, anger seethes at this blasphemy, at this puerile appeal to our basest animosities, passions that were obsolete even before the egg appeared. Is this how poorly you think of us, Star-Lords? That we might be fooled into doing your dirty work? We perceive the crowd regathering, a muttering, fuming throng, contemptuous of the bobbing, hissing robots. Humans, Urs, and others mix more freely now, sharing a heady kind of elation, as if we six have passed an awful test. Passed it. Stronger and more unified than ever. Is this the worst they can do to us? That is a question I overhear several times. Yes, my rings, it occurs to us that the glade is but a small part of the slope, and we, present here, make up only a fragment of the commons. Is this the worst they can do to us? Alas, if only it were so.
Sarah. The Uruntai like to travel fast and light, not burdening their donkeys any more than necessary. The Uruntai also believed in the path of redemption. They did not much approve of books. The librarians never had a chance. Still, the trio of gray-robed archivists protested desperately when they saw the late afternoon bonfire. Two humans and their chimp assistant tore frantically at their bonds, pleading, entreating, trying to throw themselves across the wax-sealed crates they had been escorting to safety. The ropes saved their lives. Watching with arbalists cocked, the painted Uruntai guards would not have flinched at shooting a clutch of pasty-skinned text tenders.
"You like fire?"
one warrior taunted in thickly accented Anglic.
"Fire cleanses. It burns away dross. It can do the same thing with flesh. Hunan flesh burn so nice.
The librarians were reduced to silent weeping as flames licked the wax, then split the wooden chests, tumbling cascades of volumes that fluttered like dying birds. Paper pages flared as brief meteors, yielding whatever ink-scribed wisdom they had preserved for centuries. Sarah was glad Lark and Nello couldn't see this. Many texts were copied during the great printing or after. The loss may not be as bad as it looks. Yet how much longer would those duplicates endure this kind of age, filled with self-righteous sects and crusades, each convinced of their own lock on truth? Even if the star gods never wreck Byblos or force the explosers to do it for them, fanatics like Jop and Urkachu will only grow more numerous and bold as the social fabric unravels. As if to illustrate the point, a squadron of Jop's comrades entered the camp before sundown, a dozen hard-looking men equipped with bows and swords who slaked their parched throats at the oasis without turning their backs on Urkachu's clansmen, but glanced with satisfaction at the pyre of dying books. The two groups have a common goal, an end to literary vanities, replacing the current sages, hewing closer to the dictates of the scrolls. Later, when we're all firmly on the path, we can return to slaughtering and ambushing each other, deciding who's top predator on a sinking pyramid of redeemed animals. The blaze collapsed, spewing sparks and curled paper scraps that seemed to swoop in whirling air currents. Standing next to Sarah, the stranger caught one in his hand and peered, as if trying to read what it once said. Perhaps he recognized something that was much like him in a poignant way. Once eloquent, it had now lost the magic of speech. The librarians weren't alone, watching with horrified, soot-streaked faces. A young mated pair of Hoonish pilgrims clutched each other, umbling a funeral dirge, as if a loved one's heart spine lay in the filthy coals. Several Kewan stared in apparent dismay, along with, "Lest we forget," a handful of sorrowful Urish traders. The smoke stench made her think of darkness, the kind that does not end with dawn.
"All right, everybody, your attention, please. Here is the plan."
It was Jop, breaking the somber silence, approaching as part of a foursome with Urkachu, Ulgor, and a grim sunburn man whose rugged face and flinty hardness made him seem almost a different species from the soft, bookish librarians. Even the Uruntai treated this human with grudging deference. Painted warriors stepped quickly out of his way. Sarah found him familiar somehow.
"We'll be leaving in two groups," Jop went on. "The larger will proceed to Salty Hoof Marsh. If any militia platoons hear o' this raid and care to give chase, that's the first place they'll look. So some of you may be rescued in a week or so. That's fine by us. The smaller group's gonna go faster. Humans will ride, switchin' to fresh donkeys, every half Midura. Don't cause trouble or even think of sneaking off in the dark. The Uruntai are expert trackers, and you won't get far. Any questions?"
When no one spoke, Jop shoved a finger at the stranger.
"You, over there."
He gestured where the biggest, strongest-looking beasts were tethered single file beside the oasis pond. The stranger hesitated, glancing at Sarah.
"It's all right. She can go along. Can't have our hostage going sick on us, eh?"
Jop turned to Sarah.
I expect you'll be willing to take care of him a while longer.
If I can take my bags, and pretty, of course.
The four leaders muttered among themselves. Urkachu hissed objections, but Ulgor sided with the humans, even if it meant sacrificing some of the booty robbed from the caravan merchants. Two donkeys had their trade goods dumped on the ground to make room. Another argument erupted when the stranger straddled the animal he had been assigned, with his feet almost dragging on both sides. He refused to surrender the dulcimer, keeping the instrument clutched under one arm. With ill temper, Urkachu snorted disgust, but gave in. From her own perch on a sturdy donkey, Sarah watched the hard-faced man gesture toward Kurt the Exploser, sitting with his nephew, silently watching events unfold.
"And you, Lord Exploser," Jop told Kurt with a respectful bow. "I'm afraid there are questions my friends want to ask, and this is no place to persuade you to answer 'em."
Ignoring the implied threat, the gray-bearded man from Tarryktown carried his satchel over to the donkey train, with Joma close behind. When a pair of Urantai reached for the valise, Kurt spoke in a soft, gravelly voice.
"The contents are delicate."
They backed away. No one interfered as he chose a pack beast, dumped its load of plunder on the ground, and tied the valise in place. Equal numbers of human radicals and Urantai warriors made up the rest of the fast group. The men looked almost as ungainly on their donkeys as the tall stranger, and more uncomfortable. For many, it must be their first experience riding.
"You aren't coming?" Sarah asked Jop.
"I've been away from my farm too long," he answered. "Also, there's unfinished business in Dolo. A certain dam needs tendin' to. The sooner the better."
Sarah's head jerked, but it wasn't Jop's statement of destructive intent that made her blink suddenly. Rather, she had glimpsed something over his shoulder, a stream of bubbles rising to the surface of the pond.
Blade. He's still underwater, listening to everything.
"Don't worry, lass," Jop assured, misconstruing her briefly dazed look. "I'll make sure your dad gets out before the cursed thing blows."
Before Sarah could reply, Urkachu cut in.
"Now it is well past time to end delays and perform actions. Let us be off."
One of her tails switched the lead donkey's rump, and the queue jostled forward. Abruptly, Sarah slid off her saddle and planted her feet, causing her mount to stutter in confusion, sending a ripple of jerks down the chain in both directions. One of the rough men tumbled to the ground, raising amused snorts from some Urantai.
"No," Sarah said, with grim determination. "First, I want to know where we are going."
Jop urged in a low voice.
"Miss Sarah, please, I don't even know myself."
He cut off, glancing past her nervously as the flinty-eyed hunter approached.
"What seems to be the problem?"
His deep voice seemed strangely cultured for his rough appearance. Sarah met his steady gray eyes.
"I won't mount till you tell me where we're going."
The hunter lifted an eyebrow.
"We could tie you aboard."
Sarah laughed.
"These little donkeys have enough trouble carrying a willing rider, let alone one who's throwing her weight around, trying to trip the poor beast. And if you trust me like a bag of spuds, the bouncing will break my ribs."
"Perhaps we're willing to take that chance," he began.
then frowned, as the stranger, curt and pretty, slid off their beasts as well, crossing their arms. The warrior sighed. "What difference can it possibly make to you, knowing in advance?" The more he spoke, the more familiar he sounded. Sarah felt sure she had met him before. "My ward needs medical attention. So far, we've held off infection with special unguents provided by our Traiki pharmacist. Since you don't plan to bring Ur's chariot along with your fast group, we had better ask Pizora for a supply to take with us." The man nodded. "That can be arranged." He motioned for the stranger to go join Pizora. Unwrapping the rauk that had lately replaced his gauze bandages, the spaceman exposed the gaping wound in the side of his head. On seeing it, several desert men hissed and made superstitious gestures against bad luck. While his symbiont joined Pizora's rauk in a tangled ball, exchanging enzymes, the stranger made a flutter of rapid hand motions to the Traiki. Sarah thought she caught a brief snatch of song before he bowed to present his injury for cleaning and treatment. She spoke again. "Furthermore, any stock Pizora provides will stay good for just a few days, so you better figure on taking us someplace with another expert pharmacist, or you may have a useless hostage on your hands. The Star Gods won't pay much for a dead man, whether he's their friend or foe." The renegade looked at her for a long, appraising moment, then turned to confer with Urkachu and Ulgor. When he returned, he wore a thin smile. "It means a slight detour, but there is a town so equipped not far from our destination. You were right to point this out. Next time, however, please consider simply voicing the problem, without starting out quite so confrontationally." Sarah stared at him, then burst out with a guffaw. It seemed to cut some of the tension when he joined with a booming chuckle, one that took Sarah back to her earliest days as a student, underneath the overhanging fist of stone. "Dedinger," she said, breathing the name without voice. The smile was thin, disdainfully bitter. "I wondered if you'd recognize me. We labored in different departments, though I've followed your work since I was expelled from Paradise." "A paradise you sought to destroy, as I recall." He shrugged. "I should have acted without trying for consensus first, but collegial habits were hard to break. By the time I was ready, too many people knew my beliefs. I was watched night and day until the banishment." "Oh, too bad. Is this your way of getting another chance?" She motioned toward the bonfire. "Indeed. After years in the wilderness, ministering to a flock of the fallen, humans who have progressed furthest along the path, I've learned enough." Urkachu's shrill whistle of impatience was not in any known language, yet its short-tempered insistence was plain. Again, Dedinger lifted an eyebrow. "Shall we go now?" Sarah weighed trying again to get him to name a destination out loud. But Dedinger was insane, not stupid. Her insistence might rouse suspicions and maybe even give Blade away. With an acquiescent shrug, she clambered back aboard the patient donkey. Watching with narrowed eyes, the stranger remounted too, followed by Kurt and Pretty. The remaining survivors of the ill-starred caravan seemed both pitying and relieved to be less important to the Urantai. As the fast group rode out of the oasis heading south, The fading bonfire wafted bitter odors, along with dust and pungent animal smells. Sarah glanced back toward the moonlit pool.
"Did you hear any of that, Blade? Were you asleep? Was it a garbled blur of uncertain noise?"
Anyway, what good could a lone blue Kewin do in the middle of a parched plain? His best bet was to stay by the pond till help came. A mutter of beasts lifted behind Sarah as the second party got under way, more slowly, following the same path.
"Makes sense. The larger bunch will trample the trail of the smaller. At some point,